It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Michael Bornstein was just 4 years old when his family was forced from their home in Poland. They were taken by train to Auschwitz. He survived for 7 months at the death camp before it was liberated. After the war, Bornstein and his mother moved to the United States. In 1966, he graduated from the University of Iowa with his PhD. And this hour, I'll talk with him about what he remembers about his time in Auschwitz, what he's been able to learn through researching that time. We'll talk about his life after the war. He's coming to Iowa City on Wednesday, March 29th at 7 p.m. He'll be speaking at the Iowa Memorial Union. He'll also be visiting two junior high schools in the area when he's here. He and his daughter, Debbie Bornstein Hollenstadt, a journalist, worked together to write the book Survivors Club, The True Story of a Very Young Prisoner of Auschwitz. And they are both here with me today. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
And Debbie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Michael, you were such a young child when you were forced out of your home and taken to the concentration camp. What do you remember from that time?
Well, I remember very little. I have stories from relatives, and I seem to remember the smell of flesh in Auschwitz ovens. I seem to remember Nazi boots, and I seem to remember a crowded cattle car when I'm on New York City subways, and that kind of bothers me.
It just brings those memories back.
Yes.
You and Debbie have done a lot of research to piece this story together. What do you know, Debbie, about that time when your father was in the concentration camp? What have you been able to learn?
Well, you know, for a long time, he really didn't want to talk about it, in part because it was hard for him, it was easier to forget, but also because there were so many holes in his memory as a four-year-old boy, and he just didn't want to talk about something, you know, for which he didn't have perfect memory. And so I think there's been a lot of closure in the research that we've been able to find together as a family. It wasn't actually even just me. It was my mother's a great researcher, my sister's. And together as sort of a team, we learned some incredible things, probably the most incredible and most exciting news to share with my father was that he and his family didn't arrive to Auschwitz until very late in the war, 1944. And that is really a credit to his father, who was president of the Judenrat. That's a Jewish committee. It's sort of a go-between, a liaison between the Jews and the Nazis in their ghetto. And as such, he, as it turns out, was bribing the Nazis. And one of the good things he was able to do with that bribery scheme was he was able to keep the ghetto open much longer. So they did not arrive in Auschwitz until later in the war. And that's one of the reasons probably my father is alive today.
You went to Auschwitz with your entire family. Tell me all who was taken from your home, your father, your mother, you, and also a brother?
Yes, that's correct. We were in Jarki ghetto first. That is where I was born, and that was an open ghetto. And then we went to Pionki labor camp, and we worked there. My father and my brother and my mother worked there, and then we were taken in Auschwitz.
They were also with my dad's grandmother, his dad's mom, Grandma Dora, who remained in Auschwitz with him, actually, till the bitter end. There's a very famous photo, several famous photos and images from the liberation of Auschwitz. They're photos and video taken by the Soviets. And there's an incredible picture that we found of my grandma Dora, my father's grandma Dora, so my great-grandmother, carrying my dad out of Auschwitz.
So to answer your question, it was my father, my older brother Samuel, my mother, I, and my grandma Dora that were taken to Auschwitz.
And you said you were born in the ghetto. For people who don't know their history, I mean, the ghetto is the area where the Nazis forced all of the Jewish people in a specific region to go and live, a very small, concentrated area where people's belongings were taken away. So that was the only life that you knew.
That's correct.
And then, Dad, do you want to describe how the open ghetto worked? Because it was a little different than a traditional ghetto like the one you mentioned.
Yes, it was an open ghetto. There were no barbed wires, but we were in an area and we were forced to work. As a matter of fact, we have stories of someone who is still alive who tells a story about being forced to work. One day he was sick and he just couldn't get out of bed, so he slept, didn't go to work. The Nazis came in, put a pillow over his head, took him to jail, and ready to kill him. My father stepped in, bribed the Nazis, and saved his life.
Wow.
And there were a whole bunch of other examples we learned similar to that. There are quite a few people who survived the war who credit their survival to my dad's father. And this is something, you know, we didn't know. And the other thing is they were actually allowed to sleep in their own beds. The ghetto of Zharki was their town of Zharki. So they actually slept in their own beds. They lived in their own homes. And again, that probably would not have happened for so long and so deep into the war were it not for that bribery scheme. So life was not good, you know, the life my father was born into, but it was bearable for a while. It was bearable.
But my mother tells stories about going from her house in Zharki to her parents' house, and on the way, she saw the Nazis huddling a family together. They made them undress. They made the man dig a pit and then huddled together, and the Nazis killed them all and put them into the pit. And my mother just couldn't forget that story.
Oh, no. So, of course, most people who went to Auschwitz never came out. In your family, you survived, your mother survived, and your grandmother?
That's correct.
And your father and your brother died there?
Yes, my father and brother went to the men's side. I was sent to a children's bunk, and my mother and grandmother went to the women's bunk. Just for your information, I was 4 years old. The children in the bunk were starving too. They took my bread away. And my mother, as long as she was in Auschwitz, came into the children's bunk. She was beaten over the head, but she shared her food, her bread, and smelly cold potato soup with me. And that's probably one of the miracles that saved my life.
She gave you enough food to survive and gave you her food, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And she at some point felt that if he stayed in the children's bunk, eventually he would die. She couldn't get to him necessarily every day. And so there was a point at which she decided the risk was worth it to try and sneak him into the women's bunk with her and with his grandmother, Dora. And so she did that. She smuggled him into the women's bunk. And then shortly after he got there, she herself was chosen, selected to be moved to a totally different country. She was moved to an Austrian labor camp and had to leave my father behind at the age of 4 in a death camp, hiding in a women's bunk with only his grandmother and these other women who, you know, at risk to their own lives, helped keep him hidden there.
Wow. When the camp was finally liberated, you said your grandmother survived and you survived. So the two of you were together even at the end, which is just incredible.
That's correct. That's another miracle that happened. I was very, very sick. And we got this information from Yad Vashem, a Jewish museum in Israel. But my grandmother felt I was so sick, she took me to the quote-unquote infirmary that the Nazis had as a showplace for the Red Cross. And that happened to be the same time that the Nazis had a death march because they knew they were losing the war. And they marched, what was it, Debbie, around
60,000 prisoners were marched out of camp into the freezing cold in January of 1945. The whole camp was virtually cleaned out. My father, at age 4, his grandmother, an old elderly woman, they would never have survived marching miles and miles and days on end with no food and no coats. And just sheer luck that she had taken him to the infirmary. Documents show he was being treated for dystrophy. Essentially, he was wasting away. And the timing of, you know, his degradation of his illness saved his life, for sure.
Wow. how did you reunite with your mother after liberation? Because as you said, she had just been sent to Austria.
Yes, my grandmother was a very proud person. She went to the house where we lived, and people occupied it and wouldn't let her in. So my mother actually found a farm. And
My grandmother,
found a farm, put us in a chicken coop, and that's where we lived. Then after a while, my mother came back from Austria. She found us in the town of Zsarki, and she just couldn't believe that I was still alive. She never expected that to happen.
Do you remember that moment when you saw each other again?
It's really hard to know if I remember that. I was 4 years old, and I just can't say for sure that I remember that moment.
It's been described to him for so many years. You know, after a while,
the memory
becomes
real. It's hard
to tell the difference between memory. Yeah, it's hard to know the difference between memory. And my father is rightfully so very protective of history and tries not to ever make, you know, claim facts that he can't remember. So, I mean, you know, these are stories, of course, that his mother told him.
So you and your mother ended up coming to the United States. What happened to your grandmother?
My grandmother, again, she was older. She just couldn't leave Poland. And even though we implored her to come with us, first we went to Munich, Germany, and we lived there for about 5 years. My mother wanted to get medical training for me. I was skin and bones. I didn't have hair on my head. And so she went to Germany to both help treat me and also to get a visa to the United States. So that's what happened for about 5 years.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guests today are Michael Bornstein and his daughter, Debbie Bornstein-Hollenstadt. Michael Bornstein is one of the youngest survivors of Auschwitz, and he and his daughter have written a book together called Survivors Club, The True Story of a Very Young Prisoner of Auschwitz. They're coming to Iowa City, and he'll be speaking on Wednesday, March 29th at 7 p.m. at the Iowa Memorial Union, a lecture that's open to the public. They'll also be visiting a couple of junior high schools while they're in the area. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guests this hour are Michael Bornstein and Debbie Bornstein-Hollenstadt. Michael Bornstein is one of the youngest survivors of Auschwitz. He was taken there when he was 4 years old. He survived for 7 months at the death camp before it was liberated. He and his mother later made their way to the United States. He spent some time in Iowa. He graduated from the University of Iowa with his PhD back in 1966, and he's coming back to town, to Iowa City. He'll be here on Wednesday, March 29th, speaking at 7 p.m. at the Iowa Memorial Union. He and his daughter, Debbie, just collaborated on a book that shares his story. It's called Survivors Club, The True Story of a Very Young Prisoner of Auschwitz. It was just released this month. And just before the break, we were talking about what happened after liberation. Michael, you came to the United States with your mother. It was just the two of you, and she built a life for you here. What was your childhood like in the United States once you'd left Europe?
Well, we came to the United States as DPs, homeless people. I had a high fever, being on a ship for 7 days and seven nights, throwing up, and we were lucky to be allowed to come into the United States. I just want to mention to you, first of all, after about, let's see, in 1957, I became a U.S. citizen. And that is probably one of the proudest moments I've had, because I think the U.S. is probably the best country in the world to live in, and I'm so happy to be here. So when we came to the U.S., after settling in a one-room apartment, I worked in a drugstore for 50 cents an hour washing floors and delivering packages. My mother was trained as a hat maker in Germany by an organization called HIAS, H-I-A-S, but hats were out of vogue. And so she worked as a seamstress, making $30 a week. But eventually, I moved up and made some money. I went to Fordham University, where I went to pharmacy school, became a pharmacist, and I still have a pharmacy license, and then on to the University of Iowa, getting a PhD in pharmaceutics and analytical chemistry.
And you were, when my father first arrived here, he went to PS6, which is a public grade school, but it's one of the better ones in New York City, really one of the best in New York City. He used an address that a relative had, a relative who arrived earlier and lived in a nicer area, let him use the address. And so he went to school with, you know, he came here speaking almost no English. He had a tattoo on his arm. He looked differently, dressed probably differently. And those kids, you know, were not mean to him, but they never, he was invisible. He was completely invisible. And that, you know, the stories he's told me from that period left such an impression on me, because I think about that now sometimes, how, you know, I don't think I would ever have been a mean kid who would have bullied, you know, the strange new kid who came from, you know, such a different world. But I don't know that I would have gone out of my way. Now, ironically, those same kids are now grown-ups, seniors like my father. And just a year ago, when we were in the process of finishing the book, my father got a call very randomly from someone in his PS6 class who said, you know, we're organizing a reunion, and someone remembered there was a boy with a tattoo, and we did some research and saw you were speaking places. And long story short, they tracked him down, and they have embraced him and been so wonderful. They've set up speaking engagements for him. We had our big book release party in New York City last week, and tons of them came. I mean, it was, they're showing him. Some came to his Washington, D.C. events. They've shown him incredible support and said, you know, we wish people talked about it back then. We wish we understood what you had been through. And, you know, I try to remember that now as you know, we see other people coming, fighting to get to this country from, you know, other places, war-torn places. And I try to think and remember that empathy that I wish people had shown my own father.
When you were growing up, Debbie, what did you know about what your father and your grandmother had gone through? Was this something that you talked about as a family?
Initially, very little. The Holocaust is something in my family, I think in most survivors' families, that you talk about in whispers. I obviously knew there was a big tattoo, a bright blue tattoo on his forearm. But it wasn't, and, you know, I knew he had been in Auschwitz. I always understood that. But my dad really protected us. He thought it was better to keep his four kids protected and not talk about it. And so for a very long time, I knew very little. My grandmother, later in her life, you know, as she was getting older, she did talk about it, not even in front of my father so much, but to us. We would ask questions, the kids, and she did tell us quite a few stories. But it definitely was not something my dad wanted to talk about. And when I traveled Europe, after, you know, I spent a month or two after college traveling Europe, and I called my dad from a payphone one day, and I said, oh, my friend and I are going to go visit Auschwitz. We want to see, you know, your past. And he begged me not to go. He begged me not to go. It's just not something he wanted his kids to see or hear about. And that this book writing journey has changed that, I think, right, Dad? I think he has like a new understanding of how important it is to make sure that that heritage is shared and passed on from generation to generation.
And Michael, I can understand, as you were building a life and moving forward, the desire to leave that horror in the past. What changed your mind about sharing your story?
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, Holocaust survivors are getting older and aren't telling their stories anymore. Another reason is Debbie and I were looking for a website for my picture that's on the front of Survivors Club, and we found a deniers group. Debbie, you want to tell us about that?
There was we knew that some of those photos existed of my dad at Liberation. So we typed in children, Liberation, Auschwitz, did a Google search. And it took us to a whole bunch of thumbnails of pictures, and we saw the one that was my father and clicked on it. And it took us to a revisionist forum, a Holocaust deniers website, that had captions his photo and other kids' photos saying, look how the Jews lied. They pushed their fallacy that children were killed on arrival. And look at how healthy these children look, you know, for a so-called death camp. It was horrifying. It's disgusting. And it was fuel for us to know that it's time. It's time to make sure these stories are remembered.
Another reason is I have 11 grandchildren, and they all implored me and asked questions, and it was really time. Jake, especially my oldest grandson, wanted to give talks with me, and he did eventually, and that's another reason why we decided to write Survivors Club.
My dad cannot say no to his grandkids. He might be able to say no to his kids, but he definitely cannot say no to his grandkids.
As you went through this research process, I mean, Debbie's a journalist, that gave you so many tools to be able to discover pieces of your past. Michael, looking back at your past, what was that experience like for you to learn about what happened, to put the pieces of your memories together with the facts and really paint a whole picture of what you went through?
Well, one of the things about my past is my mother. She had a saying, Gam ze yavor. That's Hebrew for this too shall pass. And so that saying helped me stay positive no matter how bad things get. And I try to teach my kids the same thing. Be optimistic. The other thing, education was very, very important to my mother, and we tried to convey that to my kids and grandkids. And some of the things that I have difficulty with is throwing food away. My mother tended to hoard food, and I have trouble throwing it away. And the other being frugal. I just don't like to waste money. And to me, that's important.
Was definitely it, very conservative, yeah.
Was it painful to revisit this past for you? Was that a real struggle?
It was a struggle. It was difficult. When I finally read the final version of the book, I basically cried because it was a hard life, but we're very, very lucky that, we have a family that has done extremely well. We have four kids, wives and husbands and 11 great grandkids. So, that's very, very positive.
Last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, just before the book was released, we got access to the publisher sent us the finished audiobook. And, you know, my father, it was, as you said, very difficult for him to read the finished book once we had, like, a complete manuscript. And I said, you know what? He'd looked at it chapter by chapter-ish. But, you know, he just sat down to read the whole thing, and he struggled. But the audiobook was like a whole new surprise, I think, and a tough one, because it was almost like hearing his life acted out. You know, there's an incredible actor actually who read the audiobook, and I know my father had a very difficult time with that a couple of weeks ago, just hearing, you know, his life acted out.
But I just want to mention to you, Charity, that the book has had a lot of success. It's made the New York Times bestseller list. It's been accepted in many countries now, in Sweden, in France. And just this week, we found out the Japanese are going to translate it to Japanese.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And also in Israel.
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations. And this is a book that you wrote with a younger audience in mind. Obviously, it's a book that adults can read. But you had middle schoolers, junior high kids in mind?
Yep. We sat down and talked about it, and 11 of those grandkids of my father, 3 of them are mine. And it was important to us to make sure there was something that all the kids could read and that was accessible to children. It's, you know, my generation, most people, at least in the Northeast here, have met a survivor or heard a survivor speak. But my kids' generation, you know, most of their friends won't ever hear a survivor speak, and they won't get to hear a firsthand account. And so it was really important to us to make sure that they have something really accessible, to have a 360 picture of World War II and what it was like for a Jew in Eastern Europe in World War II, not just, you know, what happened in Auschwitz, because there are a lot of but to find out what happened before, during, and after the war. You know, a big piece of my father's story is the bullying and the taunt he faced as a Jewish kid with no hair. He was malnourished when he arrived in Germany, and he faced incredible odds there. So, yeah, we're really excited that adults are loving the book, and the feedback has been, we're shocked. We can't believe it's amazing. But we're thrilled also that a lot of schools have adopted it already into curriculum and are excited about sharing it with middle grade readers on up.
And no, earlier in the hour, Debbie, you were talking about doing the research about your grandfather, Michael, your father, and finding out about so much of what he did, how he really saved your life and the lives of so many other people. This was history you didn't know before you started this project, right, Michael?
That's correct. That's one of the most important things that came out of the book for me, that my father was really a good man. He set up soup kitchens in Jarkey. He encouraged people to go underground when he found out what's happening. And that has really helped me with closure. Plus, another thing that I had never seen is a picture of my brother, my older brother. And Debbie has been great in finding that picture together with my mother.
And it's a beautiful picture of your brother before the war began.
Yeah.
A happier
time. Unfortunately, we didn't find it until after the book had been had gone to print. So it's not even in the book. People are welcome to go to, I have it, it's most definitely on my website, which is debbiehollandstadt.com. And if you click on the news tab, you'll see the photo that we've just found. But I wanted so badly to give my father that picture. It was really frustrated him that he couldn't remember his brother's face. And I think that I'm probably more proud of that than any other answer I found, because I wanted to give that to him, and I'm so happy. I mean, just for our entire family, really, we have this picture of a boy who looks a whole heck of a lot like my dad, actually, only the photo was taken before the war, and we did have an older relative confirm to us, a relative who's still alive today, said, oh, yeah, that's Samuel, that's your brother.
Wow.
So we were really excited about that.
I want to mention to your people that are listening in, Survivors Club has now been out for a couple weeks. It's been released for a couple weeks. It's also in its third printing. And again, I want to mention it made the New York Times bestseller list.
You think he's a proud dad?
Yes.
He's a proud dad.
That's so wonderful.
He is such a good dad. He'll tell you that till the end of time.
And I want to tell you that Debbie is a fantastic writer.
he always has to add that.
Well,
he's a great dad.
I do want to ask you, before we run out of time, there, you mentioned finding your picture on a Holocaust denier website. And, you know, lately there have been bomb threats to synagogues and Jewish centers in the United States. There has been a lot of ugly language that has been shared lately about Jewish people in the United States, but also about other religions, other groups, Muslim people in the United States. Michael, is that part of why it's so important for you to share this story right now?
I think the book is extremely timely. I think we live in an environment, as you mentioned, Jewish people have been threatened in Jewish centers, cemeteries desecrated, and Nazi swastikas painted on walls. But I think that translates to other people, whether it's Mexicans, whether it's Muslims, whether it's African Americans. I think it's important that we have consideration for other people and that we treat each one individually rather than say a certain group is not welcome to the United States.
In traveling and sharing this story, doing events to promote the book, have you been faced with hate speech? Are people being unkind to you?
No, I have not. And but
I can't believe the support. But
good.
Yeah, we will. Were you going to say, Dad, too? They have made sure that there's an armed guard at all of our events. It's an unfortunate thing, but it's the reality. You know, they realized a few weeks before the release that that was an unfortunate reality. But I will tell you the response, is unbelievable. Iowa City, I mean, I can't believe thousands of people have posted that they're interested in attending the event. We said we'll be signing books until the middle of the night, but that's okay. We're really just so excited and just reminded of what a great state it is and what engaged and interesting community Iowa City is.
Well, we are looking forward to having you here. Michael and Debbie, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, Charity.
Michael Bornstein and his daughter, Debbie Bornstein-Hollestat, together they wrote the book Survivors Club, The True Story of a Very Young Prisoner of Auschwitz. They'll be in Iowa City on Wednesday, March 29th, speaking at 7 p.m. at the Iowa Memorial Union. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.